Call to order, the House Committee on Healthcare. And we'll open a public hearing on HB 2132. This bill is being heard here, and there is a parallel bill in the Senate. The sense was that we would hear it here, and if things went smoothly through the Senate, we could move it directly through Ways and Means to the House floor without having to bring it back here. So we think this is an important hearing, even though we'll be going forward with its next step in the Senate Committee on health policy. And Rick, would you fill us in a little on what we're doing here today?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the first public hearing on House Bill 2132. This is in regard to the Physician Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment, or goes by the acronym of POLST. This would require the Department of Human Services to establish and operate a statewide registry for people who enact a POLST for the collection and dissemination of these orders. It does establish an advisory committee of 8 members to devise DHS and then allocate $740,000 of general fund for the registry. As such, this bill also has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you, sir. And we have a distinguished guest, at least a paradox. One of you guys.
Three docs.
Let's go. Three docs. Even better. Who's going to start? Go for it, Dr. Toll.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Susan Toll. I'm a general internist, and I direct the Center for Ethics in Healthcare. The three of us will be sharing with you different aspects of the POLST program, but we'd like to start with a 3.5-minute movie that makes why this program would be beneficial to a patient come alive. So if you push.
I guess we need some lights down a bit.
And then I think you have to push the play arrow.
It's the real deal.
That is all. I think you have to push the play arrow.
Mary and her friend Maxine like to spend time outdoors, growing flowers and vegetables in their retirement community garden. It's sunny and warm today, and the women are harvesting tomatoes. Mary, who is 84 and has significant medical problems, begins to feel the heat as she climbs the stairs toward her apartment. Suddenly, she collapses, and Maxine finds her on the grass. She calls 911. Within minutes, an ambulance and rescue vehicle arrive, and paramedics tend to Mary, who is barely conscious. While they're assessing her condition, they ask if she has a Physician Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment form, known as POLST.
Does she have a POLST form?
She has a POLST form. It's up in her apartment.
Since Mary's apartment is some distance away, one of the paramedics phones into the electronic POLST registry for her medical information.
Yeah, we have a Mary Hughes. She lives on Holy Names Drive. Date of birth is 5/11/24, and she has a POLST form on file. Could you get us the information for us, please?
Mary's POLST orders are do not resuscitate and limited additional interventions. Based on those orders, EMTs assess her injuries and prepare her for transport to a hospital where a faxed copy of her POLST form will be available. This scenario is a dramatization meant to illustrate how an electronic POLST registry now being established in Oregon would allow patients like Mary to receive the interventions they want and say no to those they don't, even if they cannot speak and their written orders are not close at hand. Paramedics tell us that situations like this one are not uncommon.
POLST is a written order. That's the standard that we want to find at the scene. We cannot withhold any treatment that we're capable of giving without a legal document that authorizes us to withhold that. As we're working on the person, I think if this was me, I wouldn't want this to be happening right now, if it was my mother or father, but without legal guidance, We have to do everything within our ability regardless.
Emergency physician Terry Schmidt is helping to develop the registry. She explains to paramedics how information on POLST forms in the registry will be shared with authorized emergency personnel while still protecting patient confidentiality.
I think our registry is a terrific idea. It's late in coming, if you ask me. I could have used this years ago. The sooner we get it in use, the better off we'll be, and better off the patients who have POLST will be.
I want to thank you for coming to my rescue.
Thankfully, Mary suffered nothing more serious than heat exhaustion, and after evaluation and IV fluids, is back in her apartment.
It's really great that my wishes were carried out, and the registry for the POLST form was available.
Yeah. Glad to hear that it works.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, members
of the OSU Women's Support Group there.
Yes, that's right. That's right. What we would like to do over the next few minutes is have an explanation of how the POLST Registry would be a public-private partnership between the Center for Ethics in Healthcare, the Oregon POLST Task Force, the Department of Health and Human Services, and the Health Fund Board. The Center for Ethics in Healthcare has served as the administrative home for the POLST program since it began. In the early 1990s, ethics leaders from all around the state came together saying, at our hospital, people are admitted from nursing homes with pneumonia, they get sicker, they end up on a breathing machine in the ICU, and families say, Mom wouldn't want this. That information could not get from one place to another, and therefore wishes were not being respected. Likewise, emergency medical personnel feel terrible when they provide treatments that they have reason to believe the person wouldn't want it, but they have no choice because they do not have orders to do otherwise. And therefore, they provide treatments whether or not they'll be effective and whether or not they're wanted. In 1995, a group came together to begin creating the document that ultimately has become this bright pink Physician Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment, known as POLST. It was pilot tested in 1995, proved to be so effective that it is now used in every Medicare-certified hospice program in Oregon and by 95% of our nursing homes. The effectiveness was great enough when the forms can be found, that other states have begun to copy what we built here in Oregon. And now 24 other states have implemented POLST programs in their state, modeled after what we've done here. The form is a medical order. It is different from an advanced directive. POLST are for people with advanced illness, advanced heart disease, advanced lung disease, metastatic cancer, advanced frailty. Mary Hughes in the movie is about as healthy as anyone who should have a POLST form. Other people, like most of us in this room, should have an advanced directive that talks about what we would want in a time of crisis. If any of us are in an accident on the way home, have a bad head injury, the advanced directive says who should speak for us. And ultimately, if difficult decisions need to be made, who would participate in those? It's about the future. The POLST is about tonight, in the here and now, with diseases you have now. And it provides written medical orders, without which emergency medicine has a default, and it's to do everything. This is the only way to effectively put brakes on medicine. The POLST program is completely voluntary. No one has to have a POLST form. And if you have a POLST form, you can have a combination of wanting things and not wanting things. Mary Hughes in the movie wanted limited interventions. She wanted to go to the hospital. She wanted to have IV fluids, and she got them. But if things had gone badly and intensive care would have been needed or a breathing machine, this would have stopped that because she did not want that. So it allows people to have the treatments they want and moves with them from one setting to another. Sometimes this bright pink form is not where it's needed. Many people who are still in their private home or in an assisted living facility do not want this on their refrigerator to be reminded that they have a chronic illness every time they get the milk. So they don't put it on the refrigerator, and then in a time of crisis, it can't be found. In your packet of information, you will find the story a family released permission for us to have this information about Elizabeth Hirsch. She was 88 years old. She collapsed in her home. 911 was called. She was unresponsive. She began to have difficulty breathing, was placed on a breathing machine, sent to the intensive care unit. She had a pulse form, but it wasn't found. It, too, said limited interventions. She never wanted to be on a breathing machine. She never wanted to be in the intensive care unit. Her family came the next day, showed her pulse form, and decisions were made to stop treatment. She never woke up, but her family was left with the anguish of having to make that decision to stop treatment that was never wanted. That's a big burden for many families, to participate in a decision to stop a ventilator. It's something that if it was not wanted, it's a great kindness not to start in the first place. Sometimes families don't make a decision as quickly as Elizabeth Hirsch's family did. Sometimes families want the sister to come from South Carolina, and it takes days for family to assemble while their loved one is still on a ventilator in an intensive care unit. Some family members struggle so much with the decision, knowing their loved one didn't want it, but feeling they just can't stop treatments that were started, so they actually don't stop them. That's a real burden on family members. What we're proposing is a backup system so that emergency medicine in the field, as you saw in the movie, could get the information they need immediately when the pulsed form cannot be found. This partnership would involve the registry officially administered by the Department of Human Services and the POLST program itself continuing to be supported by the Center for Ethics and Healthcare through private philanthropy. The Ethics Center would continue to support all of the educational activities statewide, educating emergency medical providers, primary care providers, hospice, long-term care, and patients about the POLST program. We also would continue to distribute forms all over the state of Oregon. We've distributed over 1 million copies out of our office. And we would continue to do the research that helps double-check, is this system the best it can be? What we are asking in the partnership is that the registry be supported by the state. We would put in $1 million in the proposed biennium for private philanthropy to do the part that the Center for Ethics and Healthcare would support. And we have already raised $350,000 to begin building and pilot testing the infrastructure of this registry. We will begin pilot testing in Clackamas County with private philanthropy, but we cannot go statewide without private support. Our goal in the Center for Ethics and Healthcare is to respect the wishes of Oregonians with advanced illness to have or to limit treatment as they choose. We welcome the opportunity for further questions as we talk about building a statewide registry that would be a more effective system to honor the freedom of those Oregonians who wish to limit treatment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Let's hold the questions at least for a bit.
Perfect.
The plan is we will have this panel and then Senator Johnson.
Yes.
Hanging in there, riding shotgun, guarding your flank. That's good.
That's good.
And then we'll have some questions, and we'll have two other people testifying, and our plan is to have this session over by about 4 o'clock.
Thank you.
Who's next?
I am. I'm Dr. Terry Schmidt. I'm a professor of emergency medicine at OHSU and the EMS medical director for Clackamas County, Oregon here. And I thank you for this opportunity to talk about our vision for the Pulsed Registry. The registry, as Susan mentioned, will help to assure that the preferences of patients and near the end of life are honored by both EMS and emergency departments, because the pulse forms will be readily available, which is something that is not always the case in an emergency now. I'm going to focus my remarks specifically on the logistic and practical aspects of the registry so that people understand it a little bit better. As Dr. Toll noted in her testimony, people like Elizabeth Hirsch in an emergency cannot always get their wishes honored because the form can't be found. Unfortunately, Elizabeth's story is not rare. Just last week, for example, I was here in Salem doing an in-service with the paramedics at the local fire department and ambulance service, and I actually asked them, have you ever had an experience where you went to a home and you thought the person was likely to have a pulsed form, but you couldn't find it when you first arrived? And every one of them in the room raised their hand. Had a similar experience with asking that same question to EMS providers in Clackamas County. So unfortunately, this is not an uncommon occurrence. So how is this registry going to work? Using privately donated funds, we've already developed an electronic database that we're in the process of pilot testing. And our proposed plan is to use the OHSU Communication Center, which already exists, already is staffed 24/7, and with a small increase in their staffing would be able to provide services statewide. What can then happen is an EMT or paramedic at any time of day or night when they go to an emergency call can call this registry phone number and say, as you saw in the video, does Mary Hughes have a pulsed form? There'll be lots of questions about, you know, what's her birth date information to make sure that you get the right form to the right person, and then they get the information and can then use that information to make sure that her preferences are honored. There are a few things that we think are key features of what would make this a safe and viable registry. One is that the information has to be accurate and has to be entered in a timely fashion. The second is that it must be secure and protected by the kind of confidentiality of any other healthcare record. And finally, that it get the correct patient and the correct form matched together every time. It would certainly be a tragedy to honor the preferences of the wrong patient at the wrong time. So we've kept those key features in mind in developing and creating the registry. And in order to have the information accurate and timely, we will need to have staff who can enter the information into the registry, and our proposal is that every entry would be double-checked a second time by a second person to make sure that the information is entered correctly into the registry, and that in most cases, the information would be into the registry within 24 hours. That's important, particularly in hospice patients and patients who are very close to the end of their lives, because things change very quickly. And if it took a long time to enter information into the registry, it would not be very useful. In terms of the security of the registry, this registry is proposed to exist behind the OHSU firewall, separate from and in a unique database, but with exactly the same protections as every other piece of healthcare information in our current electronic medical record. And so, although no electronic system is perfect, it is, we believe, as secure and protected as any healthcare record can be. And finally, as I said, it's extremely important that you get the correct patient in the correct form. So one of the things we've added to the pulse form is some additional identifiers like people's addresses, their primary care physician, their birth date, the last four, their social security number. And we're training the communication center that they should never release information unless there are enough identifiers to be sure that they've got the correct patient. and are currently in pilot testing in Clackamas County with a mock database where we have EMTs and paramedics making some mock phone calls into a mock registry to test it and see if we can break it. We think that this is a much safer system than a web-based system where anybody could access it online and could potentially make mistakes. So finally, with this registry, we think we can develop a partnership between the state and private philanthropy to better assure the patient's wishes to either have or to limit treatments are always respected. And when the time arrives, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, I'm Jean Smith, the Administrator for the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research, and we staffed the Oregon Health Fund Board effort. I wanted to review a few details of House Bill 2132, as it is one of the series of bills introduced from the Oregon Health Fund Board's recommendations to the governor and the legislature. As directed by Healthy Oregon Act, Senate Bill 329, the board and its delivery committee look towards how to transform the current healthcare delivery system, and end-of-life care was a key component of those discussions. The executive director of the Health Fund Board, past and current, both of them, myself and the Public Health Division of DHS, have worked closely over the past several months with Dr. Toll and the Pulse Task Force, which represents a broad-based group of Oregon agencies and organizations interested and involved in end-of-life issues, to help draft the language that's in the bill you're considering today. The Health Fund Board envisions a high-performing healthcare system and is necessary to improve the health of all Oregonians. The Pulse Registry is an example of a system innovation that better coordinates healthcare treatments, not only in the clinical setting, but even in a person's home. It assists providers to provide the level of care desired by the patient. We all have high hopes for our healthcare system to have better communication with electronic health records, but we're not there yet. And even in the best of systems we have right now, we don't have this interaction with the emergency medical system. And so this is an opportunity to better coordinate that care and transmit the patient's preferences between healthcare providers. This is a concern, especially in those with serious chronic diseases. The number of providers just inside one facility, from a hospital to a nursing home, from home to the emergency room and back, how their wishes can be transmitted. In a study of patients with less than 6 months life expectancy, only 47% of the physicians knew their patients' wishes or whether to perform cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or otherwise known as CPR. Only 46% of them of those patients had their do not resuscitate orders written. They were only written in the last 2 days before death. And 38% of those patients in this particular study had spent greater than 10 days in an intensive care unit, on a ventilator, or in a coma before passing away. Both this committee in past sessions and the Health Fund Board and its delivery committee have often discussed the patient-centered medical home model and what it can do to enhance communication. Its aim is to get the right care to the right person at the right time in the right place. Advanced care information such as PULSED needs to be available to the right people at the right time to make sure that the services are organized to provide the chosen level of care. This registry is a community-wide, comprehensive approach that puts a system in place to ensure the wishes of the patient are actually honored wherever they are. What could be more critical and important for our healthcare system to be but truly patient-centered at the end of life? The bill outlines that DHS would oversee the efforts to implement the statewide PULSED registry. The expectation is that the department would contract with OHSU and the Center of Ethics, building on their efforts that they already have in place and their pilot efforts to get this going. Under the agency's public health authority, the registry could then therefore be aligned with federal HIPAA protections to allow the safe and secure collection and dissemination of identifiable health information. This is a critical aspect of getting this to be able to go statewide. The department already has some experience. If you think about it, we already are doing a cancer registry and an immunization registry, which have both been very beneficial to streamline and systemize the health care. The registry is included in the governor's recommended budget, and the fiscal is actually mislabeled inside the bill, and we have some amendments. But the total fund cost is $740,000. The general fund, because we believe we can get federal match for this, is only $450,000. Oregon has been a leader in the country for dignified end-of-life care and has devoted significant efforts over the last 20 years to make it easier for individual preferences to be known. Our state is extremely fortunate to have this much groundbreaking work done already on PULSED and the work of the Center for Ethics. The Oregon Health Fund Board believes this is an important first next step to improve Oregon's healthcare delivery and transition it to a patient-centered integration of health services and providers of care.
Thank you. If we could just break for a moment and take our visitors from the House of Lords, from the Senate. And then we'll ask you back to answer questions. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We left our ermine coats over on the other side. Sorry.
Maybe.
Colleagues, for the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the state senator from District 16, and in the interest of full disclosure, in my private life, I have been a financial supporter of the Center for Ethics and serve on the OHSU Foundation Board. This will be difficult testimony for me, as my mother's death remains very fresh in my memory. I came, however, remembering how supportive she was of Dr. Toll, the Center of Ethics, and the concept of PULSED. Mother was a publicly elected board member of a district hospital until very close to the end of her life at age 93. She intellectually understood the value of a clear expression of end-of-life wishes, and in the last weeks of her life, she executed a PULSED. The existence of the PULSED brought enormous comfort to her in knowing that her wishes would be honored, and it brought confidence to me as her power of attorney because I knew it was a clear articulation of her instructions at a time of medical crisis. I watched my mother and her compassionate doctor go thoroughly through every element of the PULSED document, culminating with a doctor's signature on the form, thereby memorializing her wishes as a doctor's order. No misunderstanding, no coercion, no opportunity for a tragic mistake about exactly what her end-of-life wishes were. The only drawback for this bright pink pulse that Dr. Toll just showed you was that sometimes resides taped to her refrigerator, sometimes doesn't go out the door with the patient. It's easy when the patient is in extremis and the ambulance crew is moving fast. This bill is the first step towards an expanded PULSED program and eventually a statewide PULSED, electronic PULSED. PULSED is PULSED so that no EMT is in the position of literally cracking into the rib cage of an old lady trying his best to revive her against her express wishes. Eventually, an EMT would have on his computer real-time data about real-time end-of-life issues. This bill has a fiscal, and these are difficult financial times. But I would nevertheless submit to you that this program is critically important, and Oregon has already done groundbreaking work. I hope the committee moves it forward to continue the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm first going to apologize by saying I haven't had an opportunity to meet some of you yet, and I'm looking forward to doing that. I'll make appointments to your office and come by and get acquainted. It's been a fast session so far, and there's a lot of new faces in the House, so I appreciate that, and I will get around to your office as quickly as possible. If you like this bill, which I absolutely do,
Did you mention your name?
Oh, I'm Senator Alan Bates. I'm from downstate, down south of Mosul, a physician, for those of you who don't know me better. Thank you. Thank you for reminding me, Mr. Chair. If you like this bill, which I hardly endorse, then I won't take full credit for it because it proves a bonehead like me can come up with a good idea once in a while. If you don't like this bill, it's her idea. This actually was generated during conversations on 329. Representative Greenlick was there at the time. And I suddenly realized that quite often when I see patients, I can quickly and easily figure out what their immunization record is if they're a child by going to a web-based page. This is not going to be web-based, but I can go to a web-based page and find out what immunizations they have and what immunizations they need in the future. And that's a huge boon to us from where we were 10 years ago when we had pieces of paper floating in with kids and we had no idea what immunizations they'd had and where they were and so on and so forth. Then I realized that when I back up the emergency room at my local hospitals, I calmly encounter patients in which I can figure out the immunization record, but I don't know what they want done at the end of life, and it's a real tragedy. For me, this bill is about patient protection, about not making us or allowing us to do things to patients we shouldn't be doing because it's against their wishes. So we needed some way of finding out on a very immediate basis, within a minute or two, for first responders or in the emergency room, what needed to be done for that patient. Do they want everything done? Do they want something partially done? Do they want nothing done? This pulse form does that for us, but the problem was immediate access to it. If you can think about it, I've got a pulse form at home. It's not on my refrigerator. It's not there because that's not a very nice thing to be sitting out there when I'm feeding guests dinner, you know. Please enjoy your dinner, and I'm ready to cork. I mean, it just isn't good. And so people don't put it up there, and you can't find it when you need it. Same problem when you come to the emergency room and are in extremis, and we have to make a decision. Another very sad thing that happens is that we calmly bring people in. I'll take them upstairs to the ICU. I'll have them on a ventilator. I'll have them on IV fluids. We'll have all kinds of other things stuck in them. And 2 days later, the family finds the form and says, you know, Mom didn't want this done. She really didn't want this done. And then they face the dilemma of taking all that life support away from their mother when they really don't want that done in the first place, but pulling it away from her is something else. And they have that dilemma to deal with, too. This is a huge step forward for the state. I believe we can do it safely and efficiently and effectively. It'll be, again, a cutting-edge change for the state of Oregon. We'll be the first state doing it. The pulse form was originated in the state and is now being used in 24 states, and I believe within a very short time will be in 50 states. It is a great form. It works, and it's effective. We just have to make it more available to first responders and physicians so a decision can be made in that first couple of minutes when you have an interaction with that patient that makes a difference. That's when it has to happen, not the next day or 2 or 3 days later. There is a small financial on this. I understand that. But it is something that will protect patients from unnecessary care. And I think it's the right thing to do. So I'd ask you to consider it very carefully, and I'll be glad to take any questions you might have.
Thank you. Are there questions for our Senate colleagues before we bring back the original panel? Who's over here?
I am.
Okay.
When did the pulse form become available?
I believe about 10 years ago.
95 was pilot testing for pulse
program. Why don't you come on up, Control? Reintroduce yourself.
Please. It seems like yesterday to me, but 10 years now in my life is nothing.
I'm Dr. Susan Toll, Director of the Center for Ethics in Healthcare. And the program was pilot tested for the first time in 1995 and fairly quickly began to be distributed throughout the state and is used in every county of our state now.
And when did we do the advanced directive and durable power of attorney?
That document was revised a number of different times. Oregon was the second state in the union to have an advanced directive, and the last major revision was in 93.
Okay. First must have been about 75, something like that.
I think 77.
Chairman, just a piece of ancient history from the previous century. I was involved very directly in that drafting, and appreciated Dr. Toll and everyone who participated in it. It was quite a challenge to come up with language on such a touchy subject. And
even more of a challenge the first time you filled one of them out.
Well, you know, I guess...
because it became real then.
And I appreciated Senator Johnson's comment. I guess I have a similar story, if you'd indulge me for a moment. Because having been involved in drafting this, my mother, who was 88 and passed away this spring... we had durable power of attorney, which unfortunately I held. Sorry, but I mean, it's there's a way in which you feel that way. And also an advanced directive. And she was in the hospital with congestive heart failure. And we didn't have a pulse form filled out. I'm not quite sure how this got missed. But so the next thing I know, the family is wheeled into a room with a group of social workers and a physician, and I'm not sure who all, because frankly your mind gets a bit clouded at those moments. And my mother is, in fact, I was sort of thinking feeling wheeled into there was probably more stress than she needed physically. and they proceed to ask us about all of these things, and I'm realizing my family is a family divided. My younger sister is going to say all extraordinary means, and my elder sister is going to be with me, and my mother is with me. She's given me directions, no extraordinary measures. And I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, Mom is in bad enough shape. I don't think she will be able to state her position, and I will have to state it. And let me tell you, that's not a pleasant experience, especially when you're going to state it in front of family members who are in adamant opposition. And about that time, my mother actually stood up. She was in a wheelchair, and she says, I've had a good life. I'm ready to go. I don't want surgery, and I don't, as you remember the words, I don't want any extraordinary measures. And she sat down. My younger sister burst into tears. It was a very difficult time. But it stresses the reason we need these things.
Absolutely. Far too many of us have been in the middle of one of those. I was in the middle of one of those, too. It's impossible. Did I see another hand down here? Should we bring up the original panel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure who might best field this question.
Why don't you try it, and then we can let the senators go on their way.
Okay. I'll start with the comments that I think it's just a fantastic service that's provided, and thanks for the overview. As you're talking about the difficulties in choosing the language, it occurred to me that... Si no hablo inglés, esta es un problema que quiero cumplir el papel, pero no puedo leer inglés. So, everybody that we've seen in the movie and that we've talked about so far or testified here has, they look pretty much like us. There are a bunch of other folks, and we would like to extend this benefit to the population of Oregon, correct? And so, the language of the form, the elements of the database, might need to reflect that, and I see an answer waiting to come out.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Parker, we have begun
answer him in English?
I find that the emergency medical personnel respond better if I speak English. What happens is we do need to reach other cultures, and part of our statewide educational programs do exactly that. If you go on to the Pulse.org website, you will find a video that explains decision-making in Spanish, all narrated in Spanish, with a film crew that we took partly to L.A. and partly filmed here, about decision-making for end-of-life care when your first language is Spanish, to help cross-cultural education of healthcare professionals, because you can also click a different button, play the whole thing in English. And we are trying to be very sensitive to the fact that we have a pluralistic society and people don't want the same thing at the end of life. Some people want many more treatments for much longer than others. And this program honors whatever you want. It's not about setting limits. It's about listening to what you're telling us and getting that information from one facility to another. We will not be translating the Pulse form in the field in Spanish because too many emergency personnel do not speak Spanish. But we do have the document available so you can read what is actually being said in Spanish without the signature lines, because we don't want it ever signed and floating around for EMS providers who may not speak the language. But we are sensitive to actually the entire program, respecting the fact that there are very different views, religious, cultural, ethnic, about everything that should be done in end-of-life care, how bodies should be cared for after death, many things, have a tremendous cultural sensitivity. And that is what our website is beginning to share with others all across the country. The movie we made is used much more in California than it is here as they roll out their Pulse program. But very important to be culturally sensitive.
Thank you.
Can I make one last comment, Mr.
Yes,
Chair?
Yes, Mr. Bates.
It's been my experience in dealing with this individual with patients that there's a public out there that is far in advance of us. they want this. Especially elderly patients want this. They want to have control of the end of their life. And patient after patient after patient, as we go through this, have thanked me for having this form available. And commonly, they'll come to the office and say, I haven't filled my pulse form out yet. Where is my copy? I keep it in all the waiting rooms and all the rooms for them. And we sit down and do it. It's something vitally important to them. They want choice and they want control. And I think it's important they have that. And this bill just makes it timely. It makes it timely so that we can really fulfill their wishes. Thank you for your time. Thank you all for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Are there other questions?
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes, please.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Very much.
I have one, too.
I know it's on the back of my driver's license.
You guys.
That is an time for donor.
People who know something.
Uh-oh.
If you have some, on the back of my driver's license, I have the anatomical donor restriction. Is it possible for this to be listed on, actually, like a logical place on a driver's license? Do they do that?
One of the challenges with this program is that people change their minds. And this program allows the ability to completely change what you want over time. The most common change is that as people get sicker, they set more limits on what they want. So Mary Hughes in the video said limited interventions, but perhaps if she were several years from now admitted to hospice and very near the end of her life, she might mark comfort measures and have a new pulsed form. People also very near the end of their lives are often not driving. So a driver's license is not as good a vehicle for the group that we are talking about.
I'd like to ask a question. Mary Hughes is found laying where she was without her friend there. How do they get that other information? How do they know what her
Say
birthday
what
is yeah. or other what? Identifying information?
Representative Greenlick, a great question. Obviously, when EMS arrives, the first thing they do is not biopsy your wallet, but begin treatment. And so there are even with a registry, it's not going to be perfect, and there are going to be people who don't have enough information on to identify them.
Like I would assume her friend knew her name, was saying it, but she probably didn't know her birthday, so it's Mary Hughes, and there you are.
But you had Holy Names Drive, and that's what would help you find her.
The address.
Right.
The address.
So we'll use address, we'll use estimated age. So let's say there are two Mary Hughes, and one of them is 47, and one of them is 78. Obviously, this Mary Hughes is not the 47-year-old. But yes, like all programs, they're not perfect, and there are going to be times when even with the registry, there's not enough information to identify the right person, and we certainly, as I said, would never want to get it wrong.
Mr. Chairman, to add to that, the registry can serve at more than one place. Let's assume Mary Hughes collapsed in the garden. There was no one there. They knew the drive. They didn't even know her name for sure. But when she gets to the emergency department, they can then access the registry, perhaps before they have put her on a breathing machine. And so there is a second place to kick in the brakes of healthcare, where more information will likely be known to correctly identify the person.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for all the work you've done over time on this and on all the other end-of-life issues that you guys have been very much at the forefront of.
Thank you, and we appreciate your time both here and over the last several days.
Thank you very much to every one of you.
Can I call Andy Miller and Dave Fiskum, please? Well, tell me you're here with something you support.
Are you addressing me, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Man, you're on a roll today.
Well, this is grapefruit juice I've been drinking.
I forgot to give her my thing.
Andy or Dave, whichever.
I'm going to let Dave go because I'm...
While they're at it, let us read something into the record. We have a letter from Bart McMullen of Regents Blue Cross. Supporting the bill. subject to funding being available. And we'll, I noticed he didn't send along money with the letter, but a strong letter of support, and we'll distribute it to you, and it is in the record. Mr. Fiskum, please.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and good afternoon. For the record, Dave Fiskum here representing Providence Health System. In many ways, I really have a task today to do what you just did with regard to the Regents' letter, which is delivered to you upon the instruction of Providence, a letter signed by the CEO of our system, Russ Danielson. And I'm not going to, for reasons of time at least, bore you with reading that letter to you particularly, but we are going on record in favor of this bill, strongly encouraging greater patient use of pulsed orders. I would refer you now and later to the third paragraph where, and I should tell you also that Mr. Danielson, in preparing this letter for your review, consulted with Father John Tuohy, the chair of the Providence Center for Healthcare Ethics, and the father had hoped to be with me here today, and I would have liked that to help testify on this issue. But among other things, he raises some questions in the third paragraph that we hope can be addressed, believe will be addressed, and obviously I would yield to Dr. Toll for many of those issues, as well as the advisory committee mentioned in the bill. We think the membership of that committee is well thought out. We would endorse that as well. We believe that the state is a logical owner for a statewide centralized data record. We believe that there's work that can be done in the future relative to educational outreach, as we say on the bottom of the first page of that letter. And then in closing, Mr. Danielson would urge you, as I do, to send this on to Ways and Means. This ought to compete with other programs for state funding. The price tag, as you've said, as you've heard, is not as large as it appears to be at first blush in the bill. We think this is worthy of consideration there, and we would encourage you to send it on there. At the same time, I would add that we, like you, perhaps have been experiencing the staggering character of the kinds of reductions that will have to be made in state services, including many that we're involved in as Providence Health System. And so there's a tough challenge for you and the Ways and Means Committee ahead, but this ought to be a competitor for Ways and Means attention. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll yield to my colleague to my right, your left.
Mr. Fiskum, thank you. This will be heard very shortly in the Senate, and perhaps Father Tuohy can be available for that hearing. I think that would be very useful.
Appreciate that. I hope to get the Father here because in the issues like this, you'll not be surprised to hear me say that he'll be far more credible than I will be. So take that advice, and we'll try to work that out for the Senate side. Thank you.
The Ways and Means Sub for Human Services.
Who's on this committee?
Representative Kotek is the chair. And you're on that, aren't you, Representative Kimmery? Yes, and me.
Okay. And Dr. Bates is the co-chair, of course, and so.
Yeah. And right, yeah, on the other side. And Dr. Okay. Bates is the co-chair on the other side.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'm Andy Miller, Senior Policy Analyst, Oregon Business Association. And before I frame this in the context of cost containment, I want to tell you that when my father was loaded from the hospital bed into the ambulance to be transported to hospice, he would not let my brother, an attorney, take that form from him. He carried it on his chest. So I'm very well aware of the importance of this to a person who is near the end of life. Oregon Business Association believes that comprehensive health care reform is necessary and desirable. We support increased access to basic health care, including coverage for children and expanding OHP standard. This has been our position in both this session and in the 2007 session. We acknowledge that the costs of health care are simply too high, and any expansion of coverage without reducing the cost trend is unsustainable. Without effective approaches to containing costs and bending the health care cost curve, there will be limited political support for broader reforms, including expanded access. To address the crisis in healthcare, both long and short-term steps are necessary. The Oregon Health Fund Board has identified a coordinated strategy to control costs and improve outcomes for all Oregonians. A measure that has potential for both short-term and long-term impact on costs is the electronic pulse for first responders. The pulse form provides a way to ensure that patients' wishes about life-sustaining treatments are known and followed. Creating a statewide registry for collection and dissemination of pulse will ensure the availability of the form at the time that it's needed. OBA supports House Bill 2132 creating this registry and the Oregon Pulse Registry Advisory Committee. We believe this is part of the system innovation needed to improve care and reduce costs.
Any questions? Okay, as I said before, we've been coordinating both with Senator Montes Anderson and Senator Bates. The intention is we'll put it in the freezer for a while here and let the Senate work on it. There may be some possibility that eventually we may want to bring it back and put it into 2009 as that moves along, or handle it independently. We want it not to hold it up. So we'll move over there. They'll work it. And Bates said that he would move it if it comes into Ways and Means as a separate process right out of Ways and Means to the House floor, since we've had a chance to hear it. So thank you very much
thank
for
you.
Testimony. Thank you. Thank you, guys. Nice job. Keep up the good work. I'll close the public hearing on 2132 and open a public hearing on HB 2009, particularly with discussions about the Medicaid expansion, sections 124, 125, 126, 127. And can I call for the first panel, Ellen Pinney from the Oregon Health Action Coalition, and we have Amy Anderson, Michelle Wienker, and Amanda Stoltz. You maybe have to pull up an extra chair for this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ellen Pinney. I work with the Oregon Health Action Campaign, and I would cede to these, if you don't mind, I would like them to present their testimony first.
Okay.
Thank you.
Go for it.
Hello. I'm Michelle Wienker, representative Greenlick and committee members. I have been an Oregonian all of my life. I've raised 5 children in the Sandy area, and I'm a registered Republican and have always believed in supporting oneself and one's family with avoiding government assistance until absolutely necessary. Although I still hold those principles to be true, life has taught me that some things, like education currently is, should be available to all people regardless of their financial or social standing. Health care is one of those things. My daughter, Tessa, is one of the most loving, caring, generous people that I know. She also has a mental illness. She was a normal, happy kid until her late teens when she first became majorly depressed and suicidal. When she was no longer eligible for our family insurance, she went on SSD and Medicare. Even with those services, it took us a year and a half to get her the medicines and treatments that she needed. No matter how hard either of us tried, we could not get an appointment with a mental health provider. During that period, she spent 3 days in an emergency room because there was not a psych bed anywhere in Oregon to be found. Eventually, she was transferred to a hospital far from home and family. Her illness worsened. She became mean and belligerent, someone that I did not know. Her condition deteriorated, and eventually taxpayers had to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to put her into a hospitalization and residential treatment for almost 6 months. Due to the illness, she lost her home and will now be getting subsidized housing, another expense that you and I will pay for. All of this would have been unnecessary had she been able to get the medicine she sought when she first became sick. With a guaranteed health care, Tessa could also look for work, get a job, support herself without fear of losing her employer-based health coverage if she gets sick again. That alone could save the public hundreds of thousands of SSD dollars over her lifetime. But sadly, hers is not the worst nor the most desperate case. She has a family to love her, advocate for her, and help her navigate the system. Her father, my ex-husband, has been homeless and too sick to complete the process of getting his SSD and Medicare, something that he earned after almost 20 years as a postman before he became too ill to work. There are thousands of people on the streets without an address to send a health care card to, no one to help them through a complex system, no one to care. We turn our backs on these, our most vulnerable. We're scared of them. We do not understand that mental illness is more rampant than some of our better-known diseases, such as cancer, and it strikes one in four families. This is why mental health care must be made available along with general health care to every Oregonian. It's why you must keep the provisions in HB 2009 that require reaching out to all the vulnerable populations. It's why you must make it easy for people to get access to care instead of the current maze that is impossible for many to navigate. Doing this would ultimately save money, make our streets cleaner, safer, and more livable. This would improve the lives of every Oregonian, not just those with mental illness. You might wonder why I'm so concerned about some wretched people on the streets. The reason is somewhat selfish. First, I realize that there is only one circumstance or one piece of DNA that separates them from you and I. But more importantly, I realize that one day I will not be here to advocate for my daughter. That person on the street could be my beautiful Tessa, and I don't know if I could live with myself knowing that I am not fighting to keep that from happening. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hello, my name is Amy, and I thank you for allowing me to be here, and I want to share my testimony with you. I stand before you today after 35 years of continuously working in a high-paced retail industry, only to end up a brittle diabetic with a liver that is decaying from 28 years of untreated hepatitis C, which I acquired through a blood transfusion. Riddled with advancing cirrhosis, NASH, and 10 other debilitating diseases, I now face an uncertain future because my access to the Oregon Health Plan has been revoked after only 1 year, because my newly acquired Social Security disability now exceeds the $867 cap per month required for one adult with no children. I do not have the extra $1,000 per month, which is required to purchase my daily medications and diabetic supplies that sustain my life. Without continued mental health treatment for my severe PTSD, I cannot even begin my life-saving hepatitis C treatments that are required to stop the cirrhosis from further destroying my liver. I ask you today to fund the process of providing sliding fee scale premiums assistance up to 300% of federal poverty limits for Oregonians struggling with the high cost of health care. I am asking you to make this happen. I know transportation and green energy jobs are your top priority for funding this session, but my life depends on you passing this bill. I have waited decades to be able to be in a position to do 48 weeks of hepatitis C treatment. So as of today, I'm without insurance, and my life is in your hands.
Thank you very much.
Hi. My name is Amanda Schultz. I'm a high school senior at Falls City High School, as well as a member of the Polk County Service Integration Team. Recently, my service integration team has been trying to get a school-based health center, and as a part of that, we conducted a needs assessment in my community. We found that 61 of the 95 people we interviewed were unsure what health insurance they had, if any at all, and only 12 of them were sure that they had OHP. These results concern me a great deal. I personally have health insurance, but I passionately believe that my family, friends, and community members deserve the same as I do. They don't only deserve it, they need the health care. I decided that I would make at least part of my senior project the task of enrolling as many community members as I could onto the Oregon Health Plan and OPDP. I downloaded information offline to figure out the Oregon Health Plan application process. While reading the information I accumulated, I became very confused. I was unsure of the differences between the qualifications for certain types of OHP. I also felt the documents were hard to read and to comprehend. I wasn't quite sure where to start. My greatest confusion, however, stemmed from the fact that I didn't know when it was okay to apply and when it wasn't okay to apply, and if that time period changed due to the different profiles. I'm valedictorian of my class. I do a lot of research and I study. I was surprised to find how confusing the paperwork was and to not be able to understand it. These forms and applications are for basic services. Why are they so convoluted? I'm glad that you are looking to maximize the enrollment and retention of eligible children to enroll them on Oregon Health Plan. I also appreciate the fact that you guys are reaching out to rural communities like my own. I think it's very important. Simplifying the application and enrollment paperwork will go a long way in enrolling more eligible children on Oregon Health Plan and getting them the services they needed. In trying to navigate the system, I would have found it helpful if the guidelines and terms for eligibility were more defined, if the terminology was simplified, and there was a clear timetable for open enrollment. Also, having a person that could directly assist me or my community members would have been very beneficial. I would like to see more of my fellow students and community members have health care that they can depend on. I hope that you will make this happen, and thank you for your time.
And thank you very much for coming. I think we recognize this session more than we ever had before, that there are human faces behind all the decisions we're making, and that doesn't make it any easier. It just makes us take them very much more seriously. So you're all being here is very important to us.
My name is Ellen Pinney. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Health Action Campaign, and you have my written testimony. I'm going to go over parts of it that I think might be helpful to your consideration of these sections, which relate to specific and targeted outreach to certain populations in an effort to make sure that people who are eligible for the Oregon Health Plan can get enrolled. The simple fact that two-thirds of Oregon's uninsured children are, in fact, eligible but not enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan or the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program is proof that we can do a lot better with outreach and enrollment efforts. But it's important to point out that no outreach and enrollment efforts will succeed if the resources necessary to cover eligible children and families are not provided. In the end, DHS and FEAP must be accountable for their budgets. If funding provided for these programs does not realistically reflect the numbers of children and adults expected to be eligible, programs will close, outreach will fall flat, and because enrollment barriers for programs, like complex applications, lack of applications in communities, will be necessitated, public trust will be shaken. Covering all eligible children requires a change of frame. The authority in the section of the bill, the Oregon Healthcare Authority in this section of the bill, provides that change of frame. I've attached to this testimony copies of input we gave to the Department of Human Services Enrollment Process Improvement Project. It was developed by a number of organizations and individuals who do on-the-ground outreach and enrollment. The input was provided in response to requests they made of us to let them know how we were experiencing the application, eligibility determination, and enrollment process. The response to some of those questions will provide a frame for what I'm going to say today. The light print on the top of those pages really is red on my page, but you see it as light print. The first question the state asked us was, from the time the suggestion is made that an individual or family may be eligible for the Oregon Medical Assistance Program, what are the barriers that exist to the individual accessing the appropriate forms? And we suggested, in truth, that they should go back before access to forms, that they should start with how people find out that the programs exist. But in truth, unless you are a contracted outreach site, regardless of whether you're a community agency that does on-the-ground service with anybody, you can only get 3 applications at a time. So for those of us who are not date stamp contracted sites, what we have learned to do is to go into adult and family services offices and look for stacks of applications and try to whisk some of those away. We had a recent experience, in fact, yesterday in Newport, where a woman with a 2-year-old son, pregnant, trying to find out how to enroll in the Oregon Health Plan. We knew she needed a date-stamped application. We knew, in fact, she qualified for expedited enrollment eligibility determination. We suggested that she go into the Adult and Family Services office in Newport, which she did. There were no applications there. When she said at the desk that she was pregnant, she wanted to apply for the Oregon Health Plan, they gave her an application and told her to send it to OHP Central. She said, I have a very complex case, because in truth she does have a complex case, and she needed some help filling out the application. They said they didn't provide that assistance there. They were not very nice about how they told her that. In the meantime, I was on the phone trying to figure out if I could talk to a manager, and as it turns out, the manager walked out to our client as I was talking to her and was somewhat agitated that she was requesting this assistance. But in the end, they took her back. They created an appointment for this woman the following week. I think my concern is that without that kind of advocacy from organizations that may or may not be plugged in to the 66,000 children that need services, not all offices would know that, in fact, it should be part of their obligation to be supporting people in their efforts to fill out these applications. That's why the section of this bill that actually gives grants to community-based organizations to target hard-to-reach populations like the homeless, people who speak other languages, is so important. But more needs to be done. These applications should be available everywhere. People who provide services to low-income folks should not have to be sneaking applications from the Adult and Family Services offices. I would say that another problem we've had is that the outreach that the Oregon Health Plan, and this speaks directly to the health care authority provisions of this bill, the outreach that the Oregon Health Plan does for OHP is separate from the outreach that Family Health Insurance Assistance Program does for FEAP. They're different agencies. FEAP does amazingly wonderful and aggressive outreach, some of the best outreach we've seen, wonderful advertising on the radio. But if you ever listen to it, the number they advertised was the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program number. When we suggested that, in fact, the advertising that FEAP does should include the Oregon Health Plan, but we were told specifically that they were asked not to include the DMAP number on their outreach materials because, in truth, DMAP was concerned about enrolling too many people for their budget. This has to end. We would suggest, and this bill might even create the authority that would make this happen, that there should be one toll-free number for everyone to call to find out if they're eligible for any number of programs that they might be eligible for related to publicly subsidized health care, including private coverage and Oregon Health Plan coverage. You can see other barriers on this list that must be addressed if we are truly going to be about the business of enrolling children. The fact that applications get lost, they're transferred from OHP Central to the field, from one field office to another field office, that even when we have professional enrollment workers making copies of the application and all the documents that were included, so we know what the offices received, documents get lost along the way. You see on this point number L, there's this multiple recertification period. So, for example, a woman who is postpartum, her recertification was due October 8th. One of her children, their recertification was due December. And another child in the family, their recertification for their health care was due in June. So that requires that family to fill out multiple forms all along the multiple applications all along the line to get enrollment. I would suggest that one of the issues we experience and have heard about in the field is noncompliant parents. So schools and school health clinics really working to help children do what they need to do to get enrolled, calling the parents, asking for the documentation, and the parents, for some reason, unable or unwilling to provide the documentation. In my mind, this speaks directly to what we should truly do if we want to cover all children, which is what I call presumptive eligibility. There is no reason to force children to go through a process of producing documents when in fact we should be about the business of providing all children with health care. The Oregon Health Care Authority, in the context of outreach enrollment and application assistance in your bill in 2009, I've put a quote. I've actually quoted the language in the bill. It says the Oregon Health Authority is responsible for statewide outreach and marketing with the goal of enrolling in those programs all eligible individuals residing in this state. The goal is as vital as the authority is to this effort. You are creating a requirement for action in this bill that neither DMAP nor FEAP now share, let alone school athletic programs, reduced school lunch programs, and other Oregon programs that an authority could engage in fulfilling this mission. I want to share that my son goes to a Title I school in the Oregon Trail School District. Title I means that the majority of children in that school are, in fact, eligible for reduced school lunch programs. I noticed that he brought home a letter saying that if children wanted to participate in school athletic programs, they either had to provide proof of insurance or they had to pay this little fee, which would cover the child while they were playing school sports. The letter was silent, even in this school district, where a majority of the children might be expected to be eligible for the Oregon Health Plan, on the existence of this program. So I called the school district office and I said, why aren't you letting families know that in addition to this athletic insurance option, these families potentially would be eligible for the Oregon Health Plan? And the response was that if not enough children enrolled in the athletic insurance program, that the cost for the school district for that program would go up. That is the kind of, I think, tragic kind of mindset that we need to be about changing. I would just add one final piece to that story in that one of my son's good friends lives in a trailer park close to the school, and when I was at the celebration of this little boy's birthday, one of the kids in the trailer park came in with a swollen ankle. Uninsured, parents very concerned, but swollen, as it turned out, there was a pretty serious damage to the ankle. They had applied for the Oregon Health Plan about 6 months ago. Dad is a trucker. Dad had recently lost his job. Family is clearly now eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. The family was never told that maybe they should keep trying to get their kids enrolled. But the most interesting part of that story, when, of course, I offered our assistance in helping enroll this family of these kids in the Oregon Health Plan, is the little girl behind this boy, a 13-year-old who looked a lot like me when I was 13, a little pudgy. She said, "Oh, goody, now I can play school sports." So I hope you see the connection between healthy kids in many ways and this provision of the bill that you're looking at. And I thank you for your time.
Ellen, thank you. Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We'll have two more panels. The next panel I'll call Jason Byrudi, Reagan Gray, and Felisa Higgins. And then for the last panel will be Tom Holt and Dave Fisco. Is there anybody else that wants to join that last panel? Okay, great.
There's one.
I'll call you when the last speaker comes.
Sure. My name is Jason Byrudi. I'm currently the legislative chair for the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters. We're a group that represents employee benefit consultants around the state of Oregon. I also have an agency here in Salem that I'm the managing partner of. We serve roughly 400 clients in the employee benefits, basically medical insurance, dental, life, and disability areas. My purpose here today and the points I'd like to make is the health underwriters support the access for uninsured children and are expanding access through Medicaid. One of our goals has always been to get as many people covered as possible. We also know that the under-reimbursement from Medicaid and Medicare gets cost-shifted into the commercial insurers. Recent studies we've looked at say as much as 19 cents out of every dollar paid by commercial private payers for hospital and physician services subsidizes the Medicaid and Medicare programs.
And the uninsured
would add on top of that number. We think that a better alternative would be additional support for FEOP. We had Rocky King in a meeting of ours last week, and I think the number he gave out was 50,000 people on the waiting list for FEOP. As you know, FEOP provides subsidies to low-income Oregonians who are Medicaid eligible so they can purchase private insurance. By purchasing the private insurance, they do not contribute to the cost shift that I talked about. In addition to that, there was a study done by the American Medical Association talking about people who had made ER visits, that their access to health care went up considerably when they were in the private market versus being covered by Medicaid. In addition, FEOP serves vulnerable Oregonians. Data from 2005 showed that more than 40% of those receiving subsidies were under the 100% poverty level. The program also leverages employer dollars. We have many clients who help pay premiums towards dependents. They might pay half the premium towards a dependent. FEOP would help pay for the additional half that currently some employees can't afford to pay. And then also, FEOP gradually reduces the subsidies as people's income increases. We get calls in our office frequently. People just went over the threshold. I think it was just mentioned in the testimony before me. They move over the threshold. They're no longer eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. With FEOP, as the income goes up, the subsidy would work together with it instead of stopping one and having to find another one. I would just say that we support Medicaid and strongly encourage you to look at FEOP as a major piece of that expansion. And if you have any questions.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Reagan Gray. I'm Policy Analyst for Children First for Oregon. And Children First's mission is to make Oregon a place where all children can thrive. Growing up healthy, both physically and mentally, is essential for a child's success. Health needs that go unmet significantly impact a child's well-being and reduce his or her ability to learn and grow into a productive adult. Access to health care is not only vital to a child's health and well-being, it's an essential component of every family's financial stability. The skyrocketing costs of health insurance and reductions in benefits create an increasing financial burden on employees and their families. This ever-increasing monetary drain makes it harder every year for families to make ends meet. And for those families who are uninsured, even a minor medical issue can create extreme financial turmoil, putting families in financial situations which they cannot recover from. The consequences of going without health insurance can have lifelong impacts. Children without health insurance are 10 times more likely than insured children to miss out on needed medical care. They're more likely to suffer from earaches, sore throats, asthma. They are, and these are things that cause them to miss school and hamper their educational successes as well. They also are 3 times more likely to go without needed prescriptions, and missing medical treatment early on increases the likelihood of more serious and expensive health conditions later in the future. Even healthy children need regular checkups, immunizations, dental, and vision care so that they can stay healthy, but uninsured kids are less likely to receive these types of preventative services. Children without insurance are 8 times more likely to go without a regular source of care or receive preventative and primary medical care. A child's health insurance helps to cushion the families from the financial stresses that can accompany injury or illness. The high cost of health insurance is a growing problem for most Oregon families, but especially for those who earn low wages. Too many families have no access to or cannot afford to pay for health insurance for their children, but a child without health insurance will put a significant financial strain on these families. Medical debt is a rapidly growing problem in Oregon and across the country, and having health insurance reduces the risk of medical bankruptcy, which hurts both individuals and their creditors. The economy benefits when families have affordable health care options, and children with insurance miss fewer days from school, and their parents, in turn, miss less work. And children who have access to health insurance are able to reach their full potential and are less likely to have developmental delays and that may impact their learning. Studies indicate that improving the health of a child will improve their educational attainments, increase their earning potential up from 10 to 30%. Investing in children's health yields many benefits, including improved development, improved school performance, long-term savings and healthcare costs, all of which are good for kids and good for the overall economy. Making sure that all kids have access to affordable and quality health insurance is more cost-effective for the healthcare system as a whole. Children who do not receive preventative and early healthcare costs end up in the emergency rooms, and they often require more expensive treatments in the long run. Uninsured kids are 5 times more likely to use the emergency room as a source of care. Children who do not have primary physicians, which is more likely to happen if you're uninsured, are 9 times more likely to be hospitalized for preventable problems. And as a result, these increases turn on everybody. So there's a little bit of information about specific numbers, but Children First wants to really thank this committee for including children's health insurance expansions in 2009. There are over 110,000 children currently uninsured in the state, and expanding eligibility to this population will draw precious federal matching dollars into Oregon's health systems and the economy, which is a point that was driven home by today's bill signing of the S-CHIP by the president, and which means that House Bill 2009 for covering kids just got $25 million less expensive for the state.
Do I understand that your organization supports the part of the bill that provides health insurance for the kids,
but doesn't
support the part that brings their families?
No, we support all of it.
Okay, just checking.
What I wanted to clarify is there's a few things that we would like to see a little bit different in the bill. We are really happy about the inclusion of children up to 300% of poverty. We would like to have some sort of clarification in regarding the children that are in 200 and below. We really would like to ensure that they don't have a copay or any kind of cost for their premiums. And we also wanted to make sure that the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research is required to provide a reporting to the legislature on a two-year basis. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Alicia?
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Felisa Higgins. I'm the political director of the Service Employees International Union, Local 49, and I'm here speaking on behalf of SEIU Local 49 and SEIU Local 503 today. I was also a member of the Access and Affordability Committee in the Oregon Health Fund Board process. During my testimony, I would invite any of the other members who are in the audience today to run up to the podium and tell me how wrong I was, and we'll revise the testimony based on that. Today I'm here to submit comments based on sections 124 through 127, and we look forward to more public comments on the rest of the bill and the process of this committee. We're strongly supportive of these sections, 124 through 127, and supportive of the bill as a whole. Like Children's First, we'd like to see some minor changes in these sections, which I'll briefly go through. We believe that Section 124 really does do a really great job of addressing that issue of outreach that OHAC spoke to earlier, and we look forward to working with partnerships with cities, states, county governments, in a coalition effort. We'd also like to make sure that that folks are held accountable to the grants that they receive to do this outreach, especially in vulnerable communities. The other piece of the workers in the Department of Human Services and other state agencies have for a long time believed in reducing redundancy and streamlining government applications and processes to maximize our efficiency and benefit Oregonians. We believe that Section 125 outlines this goal. One critical element that is included in the Health Fund Board report and in the governor's bill that is missing in Section 125 is extending enrollment from 6 months to a year. So we would love to see that. We also discussed that quite a bit in our committee, and we're unanimously supportive of that.
I think that was just an oversight.
SEA is supportive of Section 126, but we'd like to address one issue in this section, which is making sure that the private market offered in this section is subject to the entire standards outlined in the exchange, which I think is also, it's meant to do right now, it's subject to the standard benefit plan, but making it subject to the other portion of the exchange.
Are you going to submit these as formal proposals?
Oh, I actually... have an outline, and I wasn't sure.
Why don't you hold that right now? Why don't you get back to Sandy in a separate
time? Okay. Great. The last portion is we're supportive of the 300% federal poverty level. We'd like to see that raised to 400%. We know that that's controversial. We also felt like somebody should come to this committee and say that. So we're here to do it. And part of that reasoning is we really have to think about what a budget for a family of four can purchase. Now that we're seeing increasing housing costs, not in home prices, but in rents are increasing rapidly. We're also seeing increasing food costs, increasing transportation costs, and so as we see purchasing power decline and rising costs increasing, we'd like to at least have the option for the health authority to revisit that should more money become available.
Do you have a dollar level for what family of four at 500% would be?
I just actually printed out the trigger link. I just printed out the federal poverty guidelines for 2009. And so it's the yearly income for a family of four would be roughly $88,000 at 400%.
We'd be talking about subsidizing the premium.
Yeah, we're talking, I'm sorry, Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, we're talking about subsidy. We're not talking about fully paying their health insurance. The other piece of the committee discussion that I'd like to just mention here was the issue of the cliff, which we think that this bill does address, is that you move up along the poverty lines, you get a better job, you get a raise, and one day you just get dropped off. So the issue of subsidy sort of helps ease out of that, the cliff mentality. Thank you, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Could you share with us, for all of us, that poverty printout also, if you ask Sandy to distribute that to us. We're always hearing these different numbers, and I think it would be useful to have it in our files.
Checking, absolutely.
Thank you.
Oh, you've got it.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Can I have your computer?
Want to look at it? Yeah, please distribute new computers to the staff.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I forgot to mention Joe Zare, so what we'll do right now is let me take Tom Holt and Dave Fiskum, and then after we'll have Joe Zare and the young lady who said she wanted to testify. We'll do that next.
Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. My comments on the sections that we're addressing today are fairly brief, and I actually going to go a little bit out of the order I planned because I wanted to, on this one of those happy days where I get to agree with Ellen Pinney on something, it's one of those kind of V8 moments for those of us who remember that old commercial, I could have had a V8. And we have an 800 number and a website you can go to for business licenses, and it's one-stop shopping. And we don't do the same thing for state health benefits. And I think what Ellen suggested is
pretty weird.
Really an outstanding idea. And that's an important element of these sections. The association generally, as we've said before, supports the goals of expansion and in general. A caution that, we're eventually going to have to look at what's doable in the current economic environment and with what we're able to finance, in whatever package we end up with out of this session. Would point out specifically in Section 126, raise a question and a concern that the bill seems to read that private insurance that employers might offer would need to be at least, doesn't say the word actuarially equivalent, but sort of equivalent to the health fund board's product that they might offer into the market. And
the
health authority.
Whatever
we decide to name it. Caution we have there is the one we've expressed before, that it's very important that we maintain a very viable private insurance market in the state, because that is who hospitals have to cost shift to in order to be able to break even or better. And there's a concern that we might unintentionally undermine that market if essentially the private and public markets look exactly the same in their benefit package, that then there's not much reason for that private market to continue to exist in the small group domestic market. And we're not sure that's the intention of the bill the way it's written, but want to raise that as a caution as we go further into the conversations about this. That's something we'll need to look at, and I'm sure the insurance folks will want to weigh in on that and would really be the ones to turn to for expertise, I think. Beyond that, I think it's almost impossible to talk about these sections without talking about the financing mechanism. As you know, Mr. Chairman, we're having intense conversations about that very issue, and we hope that they will be fruitful and productive. We are actively pursuing alternatives that we think can make some of this work. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions? I hope we'll be ready to have some testimony on that very soon. I think that.
Mr. Chair, for the record, it's good to see you again after the last half hour.
Long time.
I was tempted to say this, so I will. You'll be interested to know that in the last half hour, your friend and my former colleague, Mr. Bruce Bishop, decided to email me and say that he heard my testimony before and noted that you said good job, and he said that may be the first time for that. So I congratulated Bruce on listening, now that he's in Portland, to healthcare policy decisions in your committee. So
actually, we're going to have him down tomorrow.
I presume you probably would have him back at some point. To the point, for the record, I'm Dave Fiskum, here again representing Providence Health System to provide comments on House Bill 2009 with Mr. Chair, as you direct, to focus on sections 124, 25, 26, 27, and we even suggest perhaps 128. I do so again with a letter signed by the CEO of our system, Russ Danielson, which I submit for the record, which your staff is handing out. Providence, just to refresh your memory quickly, is a major system in Oregon. We operate 7 hospitals around the state in Portland, Milwaukee, Hood River, Seaside, Newburgh, and Medford, a major health insurance plan, Providence Health Plans, a number of special programs, including Providence Child Center in Portland, several Providence Elder Place sites in the Portland area, and Providence Benedictine in Mount Angel. Allow me to just quote a little bit from the letter from Mr. Danielson, because I think he makes good points, and I'd rather use his words than mine. Providence enthusiastically supports the expansion of Medicaid to cover all children and more low-income adults. We have consistently encouraged the state to find sustainable funding to rebuild Oregon Health Plan standard to cover a larger portion of uninsured adults. Many are working in jobs that don't provide health benefits or have employers that can only offer coverage with premiums that are not affordable enough. We are disappointed that this expansion is tied to a tax, in fact, a new tax, on hospitals and insurers. We look forward to the opportunity to discuss our concerns about this funding mechanism, as Mr. Holt has indicated, at a future hearing. We should also note that the role of the proposed Oregon Health Insurance Exchange in offering an essential benefit and subsidies as part of the expansion, we would appreciate the chance before you to talk about that as well when the time is appropriate. And I want to read one more paragraph. We do support a streamlined and simple application process for medical and premium assistance. We think outreach grants may help maximize enrollment of eligible children. We agree with increased rates for providers serving these populations, and so forth in the letter. Let me just amplify a little bit on that by saying that, as Mr. Danielson notes, we've been longtime supporters of expanding coverage for low-income Oregonians through the Oregon Health Plan. In fact, we were among those at the table some years ago with Governor Kitzhaber when the Oregon Health Plan actually was created, and we have remained stalwart supporters of low-income health care, which for Providence is a key part of its mission. We also served, a number of our staff served on several Oregon Health Fund Board committees, as well as devoted ourselves to our own efforts to research reform ideas over the last 2 years, and we'll look forward at some point, Mr. Chair and members, to share that with you. I should add that we did support efforts last session to provide health coverage for children through an increase in the tobacco tax, and then when that went to the polls, we joined a large coalition, including the governor, to support an affirmative vote. And unfortunately, we all know that that failed. So here we are again. All this indicates our support for what you're trying to do in Medicaid expansion is strong. And as Mr. Holt said, it's not possible to talk about expanded coverage, I submit, without talking about how to fund it. We do not believe that the approach to levy a substantial new tax on hospitals and a substantial new tax on commercial insurers is the appropriate way to provide for financing. especially during a recession when, as you know, hospitals are facing financial difficulties already and when the ranks of those, in fact, in the commercial insurance market are already dropping. So we submit to you that some kind of a broader-based and sustainable approach is necessary to meet what we believe are important public policy tests of what we ought to do to expand care. That said, we'll reserve our comments on that for the appropriate hearing. I would encourage you, as I did before, as I know you will, to proceed with due and great care, given the financial environment we face, and in fact, the state budget cuts for state government, which are rolling out perhaps as we speak and are available online, and those are, to us, though we've seen them before at Providence, again, startling in their scope and their magnitude for existing programs and the risk, I think, which we all face, you, us, who care about what you do, the Ways and Means Committee, is that we'll kind of be having a teeter-totter effect. On one hand, we'll be proposing to cut the general funded general programs while we talk about expanding other programs, and the latter are very meritorious for kids and low-income adults. But that is a balance I think we need to worry about in the next weeks and months here in Salem at the Capitol. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Thank you. We will have, I'm sure, a fair amount of testimony on alternative models of reimbursement as soon as you guys are ready. Be great. And I think you have a teeter-totter versus a slide, which is only done, at least you're up half the time, right?
Mr. Chair, there are lots of images. I heard the word cliff, and there's a teeter-totter and a slide, and the challenge out there from the budget standpoint, and I've been around this process for a long time, is extremely serious, and you know that, and I underline that, and we need to proceed with caution for that reason, if not others. Thank you.
Turns out only Representative Maurer is suggesting we close 8 prisons.
Only?
I don't usually get you.
What good does that do?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Can I call Joe Zare and
Mr.
and anybody else who would like to come up? While they're coming up, I noticed we've had passed out to us the federal poverty limits, and for the record, any of us who have a family of four qualify for it on the basis of our legislative salary.
That would be correct, sir.
Fortunately, most of us don't live on the
lower than 400, Mr. Chair.
Okay. You coming out? You join us? Okay, let's go.
Chairman Greenlich, my comments have more.
Please?
Pardon?
Your name, please.
Yes, my name is Joe Zare. I'm from Corvallis, Oregon. I represent the Mid-Valley Healthcare Advocates today. My comments have to do not specifically with the subject at hand today, but more generally with the health authority. If that's
no,
permissible to continue with that.
I'm from Corvallis. We're happy to hear what you have to say.
Thank you. The Mid-Valley Healthcare Advocates support the creation of a strong health authority as described by HB 2009. We have no financial interest in this bill and do not stand to gain or lose money depending upon the fate of this bill. Our goal is to improve the health of all Oregonians and to reduce the cost and improve the quality of health care in this state. The Oregon Health Fund Board, along with the input of hundreds of interested citizens and organizations over the past year, developed a plan, now HB 2009, to improve the health, reduce the cost, and improve the quality of health across Oregon. A key element in that plan is the establishment of a health authority. The way we finance health care is in need of attention, but equally pressing is the need to reduce costs of health care. There is no defensible justification for spending twice as much per capita for health care in this country as in other industrialized countries. The establishment of a strong health authority would be a major first step toward reducing the cost of health care in Oregon simply by improving the efficiency of our existing health care system. In its primary role as a coordinator, the health authority could reduce the cost of prescription drugs, for example, simply by combining the medical expenditures of the several state agencies into one purchasing entity. The transition to electronic medical records and hospital cost records could be more easily expedited under the guidance of the health authority, and the list goes on. The point is, the creation of the health authority is a reasonable and inexpensive way to harvest some low-hanging fruit in terms of cost reduction in health care delivery. The term health authority may bring to mind for some of us visions of a powerful, out-of-control monster running amok within the state government. But this health authority would be created by the legislature. Therefore, it could be terminated by the legislature if need be. Much of what would become the health authority already exists in one form or another in existing state agencies. Furthermore, the health authority would be, like existing state agencies, directly accountable to the governor. It is no more likely to get out of control than is the Department of Revenue or any other state agency. Let's put that ghost in the closet where it belongs and get on with the job of improving the health of Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen, co-chair of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon. I hadn't initially planned to testify, but because of some of the discussion today about putting the context of health care reform in the context of the budget problems that Oregon's facing, I just want to acknowledge the Human Services Coalition was supportive in 2007 of Healthy Kids and Medicaid expansion, and as the committee is well aware, when we look at human services across the board, there have been a number of programs that have been discontinued, cut severely. Among them, the Oregon Health Plan, when we remember having as many as 100,000 more people that were served at that time. So for the Human Services Coalition, we're interested to talk about the fact that we don't want to take steps back in the work that we're doing here in Oregon because vulnerable people are suffering out in our communities. Some of you may have been aware we did a press conference last week where we had hard hats and shovels, and we talked about the fact that in the human services community, we were shovel-ready as far as jobs are concerned. When you step back and look at all of the jobs that are related to the health and human services and think about what we could do collectively here in Oregon about making proper investments that also make sure that people have jobs, livable wages in the community, we think that's very important. So again, I hadn't intended to testify, but I just wanted to get that on the record. Human Services Coalition will be looking more specifically at 2009, but we have been on record in the past of being supportive of Healthy Kids and Medicaid expansion. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mullen.
Hi, I'm Dee Sutton Velez.
Can you please spell your last name for the record?
And it's V-E-L-E-Z, or Sutton, S-U-T-T-O-N, V-E-L-E-Z.
Great.
I'm a Hispanic American citizen who was turned away in a health department. Also, after that happened and they wanted to see proof of my tax or my income and I didn't have it with me, I recently called up to try to get my daughter in, making $1,000 a month with three kids, a single parent. I was told that we were not taking any more applications or kids. I was on the Oregon Health Plan about 11 years ago. I delivered my fourth child. All I had to do was make a phone call, a 1-800 number. It was very easy to get on. Actually, I was 4 months pregnant, and if I didn't have insurance, and if they didn't get me on, I wouldn't have gotten that prenatal care. I would have just walked into some delivery room and had my baby. And this gave me some prenatal care, which, you know, was very beneficial because, you know, with my third child, I had some, you know, some toxemia and some, you know, conditions that happen when you're pregnant. And so you put people at risk when we don't have enough people that can get on it. And I know a lot of low-income moms that can't qualify or won't qualify or make this a little bit too much. But here I am, a mother with three kids, and recently my daughter called, and we tried to get her an appointment and couldn't get in to see a regular doctor. They were all booked up, and she had a staph infection. Well, we had to wait the weekend, and we had an appointment on Monday, but guess what? Her whole entire leg swelled up to the point she couldn't even walk. She went into an hospital, and because she didn't have insurance and money up front, they turned her away. She hopped out of that hospital on one leg. Shame on us. This is not something that should be a privilege for some people. It should be a right for all people. Okay, so now we're stuck with a $600 bill that I have just been ignoring. I almost wanted to toss it in the garbage. I was so frustrated, because if we could have gotten in to see a doctor on the Oregon Health Plan, we could have taken care of that little staph infection, but it grew into a big one, and it could have costed her leg or whatever. Her foot swelled up, you know, three times the size of a normal foot. It took weeks on antibiotics for her to get that swelling down, and it was something like that. It happened so fast, and if we would have been able to get her in, you know, if they weren't so booked up, you know, we would have been able to get care. The sad story is that after I was on the Oregon Health Plan, I did have regular health care. And they had caught some cervical cancer, a cancer that my great-grandmother died of in the 1900s because they didn't have the test. And now we have the test, and after my surgery to remove this cancer, because they didn't catch it quite on time, I had a hysterectomy. I was supposed to go back every 6 months to a year or whatever at first, and I did that at first when I had health care, but after 9/11, we lost our insurance. We had no work, because what happens when you're self-employed, your income goes up and down, and our insurance was going up. As our bills acquired and we were charging on our Visa, our rates for our insurance kept rising. We're like, why is this happening? Needless to say, we lost our health care, and when we tried to get health care again, they told me that I could not be covered because my cancer was a pre-existing condition. This is so wrong. Here we are, 2010, with early screening and tests, we could save lives. And who are anybody to sentence anybody to death because of their inability to pay for health care? This needs to be stopped. There are so many women that are not just in the poverty level, but middle class, who'd never go to the doctors, and with that single test, that pap smear that we have, or the mammogram, I've never had one. I'm going to be 45. Never had one. I was, I recently went back, and I'm still cancer-free. Isn't that great? I finally had that retest after 8 years. And hallelujah, I'm cancer-free. But then they gave me the test for the mammogram. I'm like, I called the hospital. I'm like, how much is this going to set me back? $300 or something like that. I said, I don't have the money. So I didn't go for that test. They wanted me to test my thyroid because years ago I was on thyroid or whatever. I'm like, ah, can't afford it. You know, I'll probably have a big goiter in my neck someday. And and by the time, you know, we can have, you know, if we have access to health care, we can head off problems at the very beginning stages and save a whole ton of money. Here I am, I'm conservative, you know, and I don't think it's a liberal thing or a Republican thing. I think it's a thing that you know, involves us all. I mean, we're all in it together, and I'm you know, not just for the kids getting care. What good is giving the kids treatment if their mom isn't going to stick around to see them grow up? You know what I mean? And so we have a lot of people that right now are losing jobs and are unemployed. Their income has taken a big dive. And then, you know, we have that $600 medical bill. My son is attending a full-ride scholarship to Grinnell, and for the first time in his life, he has health care because along with their scholarship, they're paying for his health care. And, you know, that's wrong. I mean, you know what? He shouldn't have to go to a college in order to be on a finally get health care. And like I said, it's been, you know, 10 years or whatever. My kids have never gone to the only way I would take him to the doctor is if I was forced by the school district, because you have to get a physical to play sports, and they would give these little physicals for $20 or whatever every 2 years. If it wasn't for that, we wouldn't have even gone to a doctor. So I really think that you guys need to fund this. They had actually a health care system in my daughter's school at Taft, and they found out she was iron deficient. and they actually gave her some stuff from that health care facility to help increase her iron. And the reason why she's iron deficient is because we don't eat very much meat. We don't make a lot of money, and you won't see us standing in a welfare line. In fact, you'll see me ready to pass out sometimes and raiding Ray Knapp's candy dish, you know, for food because, you know, I'm not going to stand in a welfare line. And I don't want free handouts. I just want something to be affordable for people so that we're not having to go without. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Any questions? Thank you. Ellen, are you in the on-deck circle? Excuse me?
Well, they're conservative people, right?
They are. Yeah. And they believe health care is a right.
Well, I
thought that's what she just said.
I'm Ellen Lowe, and I was chair of the committee that Felicia sat on, and I would say participated, and she sort of made a request when she came up here if anybody was on that committee and would like to say anything about her comments. And I just want to say that Felicia participated well. And she remembered what we said, particularly with the 6 months to the 1 year. The other thing, though, that I really would like to follow up on, because our committee spent a lot of time looking at what happens to Oregonians who are underinsured as well as those who don't have insurance, and looked at them in terms of all the research we could find about their disposable income up to 400% of the federal poverty level. And so if this is something that really interests you in thinking about the wider picture of cost shift, I just really would encourage you to go to that Oregon Health Fund Board webpage and to look up the Eligibility and Enrollment Committee and look at the report, because there's a lot of research that is documented there. And I think it'll help you really understand the depth of the need that Oregonians are saying. I understand that you just had the new poverty levels distributed to you. I was going to tell you that I always carry this in my billfold. And so now I have both the ones from 2008 and 2009 in there, because some people are still using the old ones. But if you go to the webpage of the Oregon Center for Public Policy, the way they have done it, it's the right size to go in your billfold. And I'm sure that just as you ask the question, you often are going to find yourself in the position of really needing to respond to that question. What is the federal poverty level? But again, I just want to encourage you to look at that part of the Health Fund Board work, because it, I think, demonstrates, and it isn't so focused on health care as it is on the demographics of Oregonians. Thank you.
Ellen, as always, thank you. I think we have all the witnesses fit nicely into our time frame. I think it's because we've had a very efficient committee administrator today.
Thank you.
That's the reason. Thank you for being here. Any comments around before? Well, first I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2009. Any comments for the good of the order? Stand adjourned. Thank you all very much.